101, a version 1 podcast.
Hi everyone, Roisin Healy here from version 1, and I'd like to welcome Laura Nolan, who's a software reliability engineer, to the 101 podcast today. Welcome, Laura.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for joining us. I suppose we're really going to be diving into AI and the ethics around AI and this very interesting topic. But first of all, it'd be great just to get a bit of a background on yourself. I know you have a background in software engineering, but if you give us a bit of an idea maybe of your journey to date.
Oh, sure. So I guess it's not super unusual of a journey into software. So I taught myself how to program as a teenager in Dublin back in the 90s. It wasn't from books because we weren't allowed to have the internet on because it cost money at that time. I went to college just around the corner at Trinity College. And in fact, this building here really reminds me of some of the computer science buildings, the same sort of layout. So these we're in a very old sort of Georgian building here. Then I worked for an Irish software company for a number of years. I did a master's in UCD more recently, maybe 6 years back, and studied quite a bit of artificial intelligence and machine learning at that time. I was working at Google for a number of years. And I guess how I sort of got into the ethics and governance and policy side of things and campaigning is as a result of that. So Google got involved in this military contract called Project Maven. And I was asked to help out with that, not with the AI programming part of it, but with sort of support for that, with helping Google's cloud product be able to process classified data, which is what the drone footage that Project Maven would have been processing would have been. So I guess I sort of campaigned against that internally, and then I left and I campaigned against more broadly against autonomous weapons externally. So I joined an organization called the International Committee for Robot Arms Control, and we were involved with an organization called the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots. So I've done a fair amount of sort of advocacy and communications work for them. I'll be at the United Nations again in about a month's time with them. So that's sort of what I do.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And the I suppose the campaign started internally, but then it kind of, I suppose, grew in quick succession after. It's something that you've been speaking about a lot in the media. What, I suppose, does it look like in terms of AI in the space of like weaponry and military use in the world at the moment? Is there much regulation on it, or what's out there right now?
It's quite concerning. So there's a number of militaries that are working very hard on their autonomous weapons capability, and those would include the United States, the UK, Israel, Russia, China. They'd be the main players, although others as well, France, are actually in the game too. Obviously Ireland are not. Go Ireland. In terms of regulation, there is no international law specifically about autonomous weapons. There's just the normal laws of armed conflict, which state that attacks must be proportional and distinctional, which means that the military objective must be proportional to the damage done, which means that, you know, just because you think that an insurgent is passing by a school, you can't send a missile to obliterate that school. It's not proportionate, and it doesn't show distinction. And in terms of attacks have to be you have to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants. So these are sort of the core precepts of the law of armed combat. And what we believe in the campaign is that there's no way that an autonomous weapon, which is empowered to choose the time and the place that it strikes itself, is ever going to be able to correctly apply those laws. We don't believe that it's feasible, and we don't believe that it's safe to allow these weapons to exist.
That it's going to be able to determine whether the force used is proportionate to the threat.
Yeah, we believe that the technology isn't there to do that, and we believe that machines don't have that same kind of context and the ability to apply judgment that human beings do. And we also believe that machines cannot directly be held accountable. I mean, how do you hold a machine accountable? You can't.
Particularly, exactly.
Yeah. And then it becomes much harder to hold human beings accountable if they're so far away removed from the decisions. So, there's a lot of very sort of worrying ethical and legal factors that around this.
And do you think this is kind of, do you think the military side of things is taking advantage of the fact that regulation and legislation around AI is quite fuzzier? It's a grey area still in terms of the fact that they can probably advance initiatives and the greater public doesn't really know about them.
Yeah, that's a good question. as I say, there's certainly nothing specific to autonomous weapons in the treaty space as right now. There are a couple of national directives, particularly the US and the UK ones. And they sort of point to this as, oh, we're being responsible and we have these sort of internal directives and guidance that we're following. But when you look at them, they're actually not that strong. For example, the US directive 3000.09, what it says is that commanders have to show human judgment, appropriate human judgment in the use of force. Whereas the language that we would like to have in the campaign is something like human control. To emphasize that humans are actually in the decision-making loop and have full context and understanding of what's going on. Human judgment might mean that if I'm a commander, I could send a armed drone off to patrol, say, a 100 kilometer by 100 kilometer square of territory and to attack anything that it sees in that. And that's not really control. Right?
No.
So judgment and control are not the same thing. And the UK's guidance is very strange. So, theirs basically sort of implies that that the only things that are covered by that guidance are sentient weapons as opposed to autonomous weapons. And we are so far away from any sort of machine that could be described as sentient, thinking, understanding itself. We have nothing like that. You know, we have toys, we have statistical models that can, you know, that can parse out words from human speech or that can parse out a cat from a cat video. That's what we have, and that's nowhere near sentience. So the UK's directive is pretty pretty out there. I can't see how it could really be enforced in any meaningful way at this time.
And in terms of your campaign, what does good look like in terms of the campaign to stop killer robots and the initiative that you're involved in? What would the ideal regulation or legislation look like? And what are the key distinctions for you in this campaign?
Yeah, we want human beings to have to stay in the decision-making loop anytime that force is used in warfare or armed conflict. We think it's not acceptable to delegate that to machines. I mean, machines, they don't have humanity, they don't have context, they don't have judgment. So that decision-making capability has to stay with human beings, and it has to be meaningful. And what we mean by meaningful is that it can't just be sort of, you know, a dialogue box pops up on the drone supervisor's screen and they click OK. I mean, they have to really understand what's going on and why an attack is being made. You know, they have to have the full context. And that's very difficult remotely. I mean, even with drone operations right now, we see that that's very difficult. I mean, only a couple of weeks ago, we had that pretty terrible incident where 30 pine nut farmers were killed. And, you know, we kind of worry that the more autonomy that we have in weapons, the more we will see tragedies like that happen. And we also worry as well that more autonomy will lead to a sort of a lower bar for rich countries to go to war, especially against countries that don't have these autonomous weapons. I mean, right now with the growth in remotely operated warfare, we already have a lower physical risk to human beings from richer countries going to war against poorer nations. With autonomy, we insulate people even from the need to feel the sort of the guilt of warfare.
So we're looking at people being able to potentially, you know, trigger, I suppose, attacks without having any people on the ground at all, which would really reduce, I think, as you say, any guilt or human interaction in the process.
Yeah, it's about the political barriers to going to war. And it's not a nice thing to talk about, but one of the things that stops the world being at war constantly is that you as a politician want to be at war, you need to put your own people at risk, or at least historically, you needed to put your own people at risk. And that's a very powerful brake on warfare. Autonomous weapons, they changed that completely. They removed that brake. All you need to go to war will be money. And, you know, you need people to maintain and build these machines for you, but you don't need anyone to be
deployed physically out to a certain nation.
Or deployed physically, or like I say, even taking on that sort of psychological guilt and the psychological responsibility for the killing. It's really interesting. If you look, there's been quite a lot of written about the psychological state of the people who remotely operate drones, like at Creech Air Force Base in the US will be one of the big sort of drone operator places. A lot of them burn out quite quickly psychologically, and a lot of them find it very, very difficult. They find it hard to retain and train the pilots for those drones. So more autonomy means less problems with that.
It's definitely a very scary prospect, I think, across the board, and the potential impacts. shouldn't be tested, you know, as you say, with the unfortunate incidents with, you know, accidental fire in, you know, innocent victims passing away. I think it's definitely a scary prospect to think that live testing basically and human error can be involved in the sense of while they're developing the machines. Where do you think the campaign is at this stage and where would you like it to be in the coming months?
Sure. So the campaign is actively working at the UN level to try and get to the start of negotiations for a treaty. There is no treaty under negotiation as of yet, but 29 nations, most recently the Kingdom of Jordan, have called for a ban. Ireland has not called explicitly for a ban. Ireland has called for a political declaration, which would be non-binding. So we'd very much like to see Ireland upgrade themselves to calling for a ban. It's difficult. We have a lot of very powerful and very large nations who are invested in building these weapons, despite the fact that they have these domestic non-binding declarations that say that they won't ever do that honest. It's a difficult process. The venue that the discussions have been there so far happening in is the CCW, which is a UN body. It's sort of the second part of the Geneva Convention. So it's sort of a specialised Geneva Convention type body, and it deals with conventional weapons, which are basically projectiles, lasers, explosives. It deals with bombs of any kind, missiles, that kind of thing. Those are conventional weapons. So as opposed to nuclear and biological weapons and chemical weapons, which it does not deal with. So the CCW, unfortunately, it's a consensus-based body. So I've witnessed this a couple of times. I've been to these meetings and you will see 100 countries stand up and say, you know, we are very concerned about this issue and we would like to, you know, move forward to a treaty or we'd like to have, you know, 15 days of discussion next year or 10 days of discussion. And then, you know, most recently, Russia will stand up and say, well, actually, we think that 5 days of discussion will be more than adequate. So you get this sort of political maneuvering where instead of saying, well, oh, no, we're absolutely never going to allow a treaty to happen about autonomous weapons, they won't come out and directly say that.
There's probably more stalling tactics than anything.
They stall, exactly. They slow down discussions. So last October or November, November it would have been 2018, there was a meeting of the high contracting parties and Russia stood up and they essentially stonewalled out. Every other country was voting for 10 days of deliberation this year about autonomous weapons. And they said that they would only accept 5. And the compromise was eventually landed on 7. But it's not long enough. There's complex issues here. And there are a lot of factors to be weighed. So, for example, we're not trying to ban things like precision-guided munitions, which are sort of, you could look at them and you could squint and go, okay, well, they're kind of autonomous because they have some latitude in how they maneuver to their target. But they're not what we're focusing on banning here. Mm. You know, they are targeted by a human being and the target is chosen by a human being and the time that they will be deployed is chosen by a human being. And all they
I
have
think
is,
that's the key distinction of the campaign to stop killer robots is that human intervention piece.
Exactly.
And human involvement in the decision-making process.
Exactly. It's about keeping that human control, that human involvement. A lot of people hear the campaign to stop killer robots and they go, okay, well, these are a bunch of crackpots and they're worried about Skynet and the machines rising up. And that is actually pretty much the opposite of what we're worried about. You know, I worry about the robots being pretty terrible and being so dumb that they can't comply with the laws and the norms of armed conflict. We worry about bad robots making a lot of errors and just sort of generally being terrible, right? We don't worry about them rising up and becoming Skynet. That's not what this is about.
I think the media has had a lot of involvement in giving the wrong impression, I suppose, of AI, and I think it's kind of the stuff of sci-fi films as well, you know, that people are more worried about robots becoming so autonomous, you know, that they'll be sitting next to us and, you know, on the train on a day-to-day basis and going through the world. But that's really not, I suppose, as they say, the risk there. The risk is that poorly, poorly autonomous, you know, robots would be involved in the likes of warfare or, you know, situations where people could seriously be harmed.
Yeah, I mean, we have a century now, more or less, probably more at this point, of science fiction that's been telling us that we're going to have computers and artificial intelligence that are going to have human-like capabilities that will be able to think and understand and even have emotions like a human being. Mm. And this is not the way the technology is panning out, not even in the slightest. So, but people have very wrong impressions, and the industry actually fuels that. So I don't know if you've seen, there was a great example last year. There was this robot called Sophia, which is sort of a show robot.
I did. Yeah, I saw Sophia.
Sophia is nonsense. I mean, everything that Sophia does on camera is scripted out by a human being. It's sort of a glorified tape recorder. And all it does is it sort of gives the right responses in response to the right questions. That's not very smart.
So but it's no different really than an Alexa or a Siri, in a sense of that it's kind of, I suppose, command and prompting.
Exactly.
Response.
Yeah, yeah. It's very much like a Siri or Alexa, just housed in a sort of a more humanoid type body. And, you know, we have countries giving this thing visas. Nonsense.
Oh, my God.
Absolute nonsense.
Do you think it's kind of like the anthropomorphizing the AI bot, I suppose, triggers a more emotional response in people, that they think, you know, it looks more human, it feels more human, therefore it must have human emotions, where, you know, it is no different than an Alexa that sits on the desk.
Absolutely. We've got huge biases about these things. And the same is true of your digital smart home assistants as well. I mean, they're given human-like voices for a reason. And, you know, they program them to tell you jokes and, you know, sort of be as engaging as possible. And yeah, a lot of it is about trying to make them seem smarter than they are. But I know if I, we have a Google Home in the house, and I swear to God, I wouldn't have it if I could have any say in the matter, but I've been overruled because it's the hub for the home automation stuff that my partner likes. And but you ask it the simplest question, like, you know, hey, Google, is kind of, does the restaurant down the road take a reservation? And I guarantee you it won't be able to come back with the right answer. Like,
it'll probably give you the weather.
Probably. I mean, who knows what it would do.
I get plenty of definitions from Alexa when I'm asking her what time it is. So, in terms of, I suppose, AI and innovation in general, I know a lot of our listeners, you know, organizations work on innovation projects and are looking at kind of exploiting emerging tech like AI, machine learning. What kind of safeguards can companies put in place, or what does good look like in terms of regulation, and how can companies know that they're engaging in AI kind of effectively and safely?
So actually, we're lucky to live in the EU. So we actually have some regulation on this, and not everyone knows this. People think of the GDPR and they go, okay, well, the GDPR is the thing why I have to click OK on I accept cookies all the time. But Article 22 of the GDPR is all about algorithmic decision making. Now, it is not specific to AI decision making, but it would cover it, right? So, and I think this is good. Law should be about outcomes, not about implementation details, which is what AI is. So I'm very much a proponent of make your law about technology in general and make your policies about technology in general, not about AI, because AI is so vague and fluffy. But anyway, Article 22, it says that if you have automated decision making that is going to have any sort of material effect, like a legal effect, but or anything else similarly important on a person, that they have to have the right to have that decision checked by a human being if they ask for that to be the case. So this would cover all sorts of things, like anything to do with the legal process is obvious. So if you, like, for example, it would be illegal for you to implement, say, a parole decision-making system that would help lawmakers decide what parole to give people, unless people had the ability to sort of interrogate that system and understand why it was making the decisions it was making, and to have a right of appeal to a human being. Other kinds of important scenarios where this sort of thing would kick in would likely be things like loan applications or job applications, definitely things like social welfare benefits. So we've actually got some decent protections here in Europe. I mean, certainly more so than other parts of the world. I think Canada is looking at bringing in something a little bit like this, but as far as I'm aware, the GDPR Article 22 is sort of the gold standard so far.
That's good that it kind of builds in basically that judgment piece, you know, mm-hmm. that there is human intervention in the outcomes for human beings.
Yeah.
In terms of scenarios, I'll ask you, I suppose, the good scenarios with AI. But what would you say are some of the scariest uses of AI? I know the killer robots obviously are top of the agenda, but are there other areas that people, particularly, you know, people involved in the development of software and tech should be aware of out there?
Yeah, there's a lot of things to worry about. So definitely we should worry about bias. So a lot of the times when people have tried to bring in sort of AI-based systems, they find that there are unintended outcomes, because what these systems typically do is they attempt to take a bunch of training data, which is based on sort of historical applications of some process, and to build a statistical model based on that, which that they can then apply to future decisions. So, for example, Amazon, a couple of years back, they tried to introduce a system for screening job applications, job candidates. And it turned out that it was sexist. Amazing. And this was because their historically, their processes for weeding out candidates had had a sexist result, right? So they tried to even sort of to fix this by not taking the applicant's gender into account. And they found that this is so hard to do because there are so many proxies for it. So, for example, sports that you might play that you might list on your CV. If you're playing Camogie, your chances are you're a woman, right? Which kind of schools people would go to. It's very hard.
Gender is kind of built into everything systematically more so than a name or a list of gender on a sheet.
Yeah, exactly. And the same is true for a lot of other types of sort of socioeconomic indicators, like where you live is highly indicative of sort of the, your income level, maybe indicative of race, all these things. There's all sorts of, we call these sort of proxy features, and these are everywhere. It's extremely hard to control for this. It's extremely hard to test your systems to make sure that you don't have these kinds of biases built in, right?
And what I know this is actually an issue for many companies. I've been to a good few talks over the past year or so in terms of bias and building bias into bots. Are you aware of any, are you aware of any ways to prevent bias being built into, our systems and our bots, and how to, take a diverse approach to ensuring that, systems aren't going to discriminate against things like race and gender? An age?
It's extremely difficult. People have been working very hard on this, and the gold standard seems to be to sort of black box test your systems after you've built them. So literally, like if we look at our example of a job application system, take input CVs to that, and change variables. So, change names, change addresses, change people's school that they went to, and see what is actually influencing the outcome, and decide if you're okay with that.
So, if it was to make a decision and the address was to change, if A produced a different response to B, then you'd know that there's a bias built in.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah, I mean, most likely. So. But the gold standard has to be that you can't assume that your systems are perfect, and you have to build processes around that. So it's very important, I think, to be, if you're building these systems, that end users, but of course it's not always the people who are actually using this system that are impacted by it. Mm. For example, your social welfare caseworker may be the user, but you're the person who's affected. You're a stakeholder as well. It's super important to know that a stakeholder. To make the stakeholders aware that they're being impacted by these systems, so that they can inform themselves as to what these systems are doing, and to, like I say, request that sort of human appeal if they feel like they need to.
No, that makes sense. In absence of having solid regulation available for businesses, what can kind of business decision makers do and engineers do to ensure that they build some sort of safeguards into their AI and other kind of tech development?
Yeah. So earlier this year, European Union AI High Level Expert Group brought out a set of guidelines, which are probably the best I've seen so far. So they're not rocket science. They're exactly what you'd expect. But first off, respect all the applicable laws. So Article 22 of the GDPR that we talked about, and data governance is really important because these systems tend to deal with a lot of personal information. Then there's sort of basic ethical principles and values. So are we respecting human rights and fairness and the public good? I mean, and that sometimes you have to sort of step back and take a whole look at your system and decide if it's okay. They should be well engineered in general. They should be sort of self-monitoring and sort of noticing when things are strange and have a way to escalate to out of the system to a human being. I think that's quite important with decision-making systems.
You're building in the assumption into the system that the system may not be perfect.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite useful to sort of build something that monitors for unusual results from it. And that's a very common pattern when you're trying to build reliable systems. You sort of build like a second system that monitors the first system to look for really strange stuff. We see this kind of system, that kind of pattern a lot. test it as much as you can to make sure that there aren't undue biases in there. There are people who actually do this for a living now. I mean, it's a really good thing to have audited by an external consultant. Transparency, like I say, people need to know that they're subject to this system. And the system needs to be accountable and auditable, so the system should be keeping records of every decision it makes and, as much as possible, what went into the making of that decision. So one of the great challenges around current sort of machine learning and AI technologies is they tend to be very black box. It's often very hard for them to sort of pinpoint why a particular thing was classified the way it was. Why was somebody classified as a high risk mortgage applicant as opposed to a low risk? I mean, the system doesn't know. All it knows is that, you know, a bunch of information about your credit history went into one end of the sausage machine and a score came out the other, and it's just statistics and just sort of weights and numbers in the middle. Like, there's nothing that you can point to as a human being and say, well, it's this.
This is what occurred in the decision-making process.
Yeah. As opposed to a human decision maker may not be perfect either, but at least, you know, they'll go through it and they'll say, well, it looks like you've got some gambling here 6 months ago, so don't do that anymore.
Yeah, they might be able to balance the kind of, I suppose, the risks as they go along. We've looked, I suppose, at the more worrying uses of AI. What would you say are the best opportunities for AI, or the most positive initiatives that you've maybe observed, or kind of uses that you feel would be very positive for AI?
Well, I mean, if you want to find your cat videos, it's pretty great for that. No, but in all seriousness, the current sort of resurgence in AI techniques, it's been, I guess, I think there's sort of been two eras of AI in the last 10 years. So the first era came when we sort of started to have large online stores and sort of large online content repositories for the first time. And what happened then was this sort of growth in AI for recommendation systems. So we see this in all sorts of online online sales. So Amazon pretty much, I don't want to say that they invented this field, but, you know, certainly they were the first sort of big, well-known example. You know, people who shopped for, you know, like staplers also may have shopped for paperclips. So that sort of recommendation stuff, or people like you who read these three books, they also liked this book. So there was a sort of a lot of AI for recommendation purposes. That's also really heavily used in social media. I mean, you don't see everything that your friends post. Facebook or Twitter are picking out things that it thinks that you're going to engage with. Now, you can question whether or not these are all positive uses. I mean, these are people who are trying to either get your eyeballs or get your money. But it's certainly been a very big theme in the last 10 years. And then the second big spike in AI applications has been really when deep learning was invented, and suddenly object recognition in images and video got a lot better, and parsing words out of people's voices, like voice recognition, word recognition in speech started to become feasible. So it's all about sort of sensing the world, right? So we now have machines with the ability to sense pictures and video and sounds in semi-useful ways, right? And this has sort of led to this explosion in things that have kind of not really paid off in many ways yet, right? So autonomous driving, I think, is a great example of this. They've been working on that for years, and they've sort of gotten 90% of the way there, but it's not quite there. And 2 years ago, you had all of the CEOs of the big autonomous driving companies were, you know, swearing blind that we'd be all in our autonomous taxis in 2022. And now they're like, oh, I don't know if that's ever going to happen. I mean, they're starting to show doubt, because it is genuinely a very hard problem to get to that last part. I mean, especially living here in Dublin, I think we can all look at some of the stuff that goes on Dublin street layout and think, oh, well, you know, I think you'll have a hard time with that. It's not
predicting,
like,
it. Yeah, it's not exactly a straight grid to navigate.
It's not. No, I mean, we'll have quite a large challenge.
I think it's more reassuring, though, to see that there's some doubt there as opposed to blind confidence in AI.
Yeah. So I think there is definitely a lot of scope to apply these kinds of technologies. I mean, both of those kinds of technologies. In terms of the recommendation systems approach, I actually think there's quite a lot of scope for that in knowledge work. You know, why are people not working as hard to to help me do my academic research as they are to help me find the perfect paper clips to go with my stapler. I mean, nobody is really doing that yet. And it's quite hard to find information, you know, still in sort of academic journals and papers. And, you know, you have to think of all the sort of different variations of what you might want and type all the different search terms in and scan through documents yourself. So I think there's a huge amount of scope to bring these tools to research that I think could be really transformative. And then in terms of the end of the area of machines interacting with the real world, I mean, there's actually quite a lot of applications that are really good here. So, for example, robots doing dangerous stuff like mine clearance, that's brilliant. I mean, we don't want people to have to go and risk their life and limb to do this sort of work. Drones for search and rescue. I mean, I used to be very big into scuba diving. I don't do that quite so much anymore, but I can tell you being lost at sea is a damn scary thing. And if you have a whole bunch of drones that can go out to sea and reliably spot human beings that are floating in the water, like that's a fantastic thing.
It's a transformative use.
Absolutely transformative. And the same for mountain rescue as well. So there's a lot of good applications there. There's humanitarian applications. So there's humanitarian organizations like disaster relief that use this to sort of scan aerial photos and satellite footage of areas that have had a natural disaster and try and assess what the needs are for disaster relief, like how many tents are they going to need. And that's pretty useful as well. So there's a lot of great uses.
No, there is, and it's not all negative with AI, but we still do have to be, I suppose, have some sort of an idea of how to filter through what the media is showing us to, and to know kind of what the ultimate expectation should be of AI, and to kind of keep that, I suppose, human judgment piece, you know, to front of mind.
Yeah, it's about understanding what are the strengths and the limits of these technologies. You know, where do we need to keep that human judgment in? And, you know, as with all technology, and this has been this way since the invention of the punch card, you know, we need to think about ultimately what are the aims of what we're doing? Is what we're doing socially beneficial or not?
I think we could probably keep talking about this topic all day, Laura, but we have to wrap up this episode. But thanks very much for joining us on the podcast and for talking to us as well about the campaign to stop killer robots. And as you said, the listeners can find more information on your website, stopkillerrobots.org. And we'll probably be hearing a lot more from you in the coming months as well.
I hope so. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the 101 podcast. If you would like more information about any of our podcasts or our guests, visit us at version1.com/1-0-1.